Samaria and no America. Well, Samaria was the capital city of the 10 tribes of Israel for quite a very many years, 158 years, in fact. And the nation, the 10 tribes of Israel, were often referred to nationally as, by their capital name, as Samaria. So what we're going to look at is Samaria and America. They sort of rhyme. They have the A at the end, and they have similar syllables, and yes, they do rhyme, and there's a reason why Marika is the core of America. The A on the front is added. But America was the tribe of Manasseh back in those days. But we want to look at the history of America and Samaria, see some of the overlays without getting into too much of the tribal identity details. So let's wade through this. I find it very fascinating. When we personally face troubles on every side, or when the Church of God faces spiritually destructive forces, and those of you newer to the Church aren't privy to the history in the 20th century, in the 21st century, that the Church has faced, the challenges it's faced, you can ask those who've been around a long time, they can tell you some stories. And those are important stories to hear, especially from those who remember it firsthand. Some good spiritual lessons from it. So when we personally face troubles on every side, when the Church faces destructive troubles, or even when our nation faces trouble, well, of course, we're in a trouble-free time in America right now, aren't we? Hardly. We're in a really, really sad and frightful time in America. That's when we tend, though, when those times are happening, we tend to look for guidance in the history and the wisdom found everywhere in the Bible. Finding guidance in history, oh yes. That's why we can cite various important events that occurred in American history, and we draw lessons from them. And if we know the history of other nations, you can draw lessons from some of them, too. We're more invested in America, so it runs a little deeper when we're looking at things. America has faced political unrest and powerful enemies over the past 245 or 46 years, however old our nation actually technically is. And God has overall blessed the nation with unprecedented blessings, wealth, and influence and such. I remember reading about one of the battle plans of Japan used in World War II against America. Maybe you didn't hear about it, but they were going to, it was Ringlong bombing. And they actually came up with a reasonable plan for the time. Remember, the technology was the 1940s. They were going to use hot air balloons, or I think they were helium balloons, high-altitude balloons carrying incendiary bombs. And they would launch them from Japan when the winds were right, and they would get picked up and carried in the high winds that go over the ocean, and then come back down and across the northwest of America, right in Washington, in Northern California. Now, it was really, from a destructive point of view, a brilliant plan. There was one problem that he had, and that was pinpointing where the bomb would do the most destruction. San Francisco, which is where a lot of the ships, the warships, were being built. They didn't work because there was too much intervening land that wasn't forested enough to carry it all the way to Northern California. But the pastor and his family were camping, and the wife and the children found a balloon, remains of it, and some apparatus that hung from it, including the bombs, and some of them were still there. And they dragged it back to there where they were camped. And one of the bombs went off and killed the mother and one of the children. So it was a tragedy when it happened, but that was one of the big battle plans of the Japanese. Came to nothing. America has been blessed in a lot of other ways, though. A lot of other ways. But how do we understand the times in which we now live? One way is to look back in history and find parallels to our times and circumstances. I already mentioned that. But in this Bible study, we're going to focus on the ancient past to better understanding today's troubles. Go back to the past, study what happened with mankind and with human, the way human nature created the behaviors of mankind, and learn from that, because we deal with the same exact carnal, selfish human nature that the ancients had. They haven't changed. All we have changed is technology. People are the same. When I say people are the same, they're the same for good, but largely they're the same for bad. Now we're going to look, therefore, at a little bit of the history of Samaria, which was the capital city of the 10 tribes of Israel, from the primary capital. They had two or three other ones before they got Samaria, but they didn't last very long. This was their long time one. And then we'll draw some lessons forward to America and to our lives today. Give you a quick background. I think we're all familiar with when King David ruled the 12 tribes of Israel. All the tribes were under King David. They'd all been under King Saul. But Saul wasn't a very wise ruler. Ultimately, David ruled all the 12 tribes. Solomon ruled all the 12 tribes, his son. And then Solomon had a son whose name was Rehoboam. Rehoboam on the end, Rehoboam. Rehoboam somehow did not inherit the wisdom genes, nor did he have heart for worshiping the true God. So he became a hard-nosed leader against the tribes that he didn't like, and mostly those were the northern tribes. Consequently, 10 tribes broke off. This was just within about 5 years of when Solomon had died. And Rehoboam had taken over. The 10 tribes broke off and formed their own nation. So you had the tribe of Judah and Benjamin to the south, along with the bulk of Levi, because they were the priests. And then just north of Jerusalem, a few miles, was the border. And from then on, all the way up to Tel Dan, when you look at a map of the map here, the Bible, was the 10 tribes, the house of Israel. So you had the south, the house of Judah, in the north, the house of Israel. Israel had a capital, the primary one, as I said, they bounced from three or four different sites. They landed in Shechem, and they had their pagan idols. See, the sad thing about it, you think, well, that must have been a great patriotic thing for when they broke away from this, you know, this oppressive king. It's kind of like America breaking away from King George III. No, it wasn't. The 10 tribes had no heart for following God at all. They just went immediately back to the paganism of all of the nations around them. They were surrounded by, well, I guess they can't be surrounded by the Mediterranean, but on the other sides, they were surrounded by pagan cultures that worshipped many gods and goddesses and had completely forgotten anything about the true God. And so the Israelites, who had the knowledge of the true God and the truth, like we have the truth today, in the midst of a Christianity that is lost, a vast bulk of it. They had the truth, but then they lost it. They gave it up. They walked away from it. Now, many prophecies against disobedient Israel are addressed to Samaria. So often the prophets spoke of the capital in reference to the people that lived in that country. So sometimes it would, the prophecies, if it was to the house of Judah, it was addressed to Jerusalem. When the prophecy, the prophets were inspired to warn the nation, it would be addressed to those who were sent to speak to the northern 10 tribes, like Elijah and Elisha say, and then draw roughly a line across to the Joppa, more or less. South of that is the house of Judah, the kingdom of Judah. North of that is the kingdom of Israel. Up until you get to where the Phoenicians are. But you go all the way up into Galilee and all the way almost to Damascus. But Damascus was just outside across their borders. So that gives you an idea. Samaria is in the lower left quadrant of that, closer to the sea. Because if you notice that route, the layout there, along the seacoast would be a good place for a train route. And it was. Mainly because you'd have to go up and down the mountains all the time. So there was a major trade route that went right up this, what came from Africa through Egypt and right around and up along the Mediterranean Sea, going on up further to other countries to the north. And back and forth they went. There was another trade route when you look at where, again, using the Dead Sea to mark off on it, or choosing a spot, and you find roughly where Samaria would have been north of Jerusalem a ways. There was another route that came right across there. That was the lower part of the mountains. There was some gaps in the mountains. And across there, there was another one that went inland by the Sea of Galilee, north of the Sea of Galilee. So that one went from east to west and then went up north to east to west. That trade route at the south, though, was the important one, and Samaria guarded it. Because of its location on the mountain ridges, it could guard the way of the sea, which was the trade route along the sea. And then they could go over the ridge of the mountains, and they could drop down across the Jordan River and get to the other side of the nation of Israel very easily. Samaria, therefore, was built to be in the nerve center. It was also in the territory of the land of Manasseh. Manasseh is the ancestor of America. Served as a capital of the 10 tribes for 158 years. The city of Samaria came to its end in 722 B.C., as far as the Israelites went. That's when it was conquered by the Assyrians, who we believe are the ancestors of most of the Germanic peoples. Israelite population was taken into Assyrian captivity. God warned them, if they didn't repent of their sins and follow the truth, which they knew, that he would send them into captivity. They would be conquered and taken into captivity, and it was Assyria that he used as the rod of his anger. He calls Assyria that at a certain point in one of the prophets. Assyria resettled the Babylonians let me tell you where they took the Israelites. They took the Israelites north. Assyria was, when you go far enough up the coast, then you get into the Fertile Crescent that crosses over. So you're not going across the desert to get over to what we call Iraq and Iran today. You go up and you go over down the Euphrates River. And that's a green area that goes across there. It's in Anatolia today, essentially. Southern Anatolia, which is on the edge of Turkey. So they were taken into captivity up there, was the empire of the Assyrians. And their strategy ultimately was they would take their people and captive peoples like this. They deported entire populations. And they would move them lock, stock, and barrel up there and dump them off. And then they would, in a place where they perhaps had moved some troublesome population before, they would build a town, and then they would arm them. And they were the first ring of their defense against any invaders from the north. So they irritated the Israelites by conquering them and humiliated them by deporting them. Really had them angry. And then they parked them on their northern border and they gave them weapons. That's going to have repercussions in due course. And it did. Now, let's look at the Samaritans in the time of Christ. We're going to jump forward to the time of Christ. The captivity was in the 700s B.C. So, that 720s B.C. when it took place. So, we're going down close to 700, 20 years to the time of Christ. John chapter 4. Let's go to John chapter 4. We're going to read the first 11 verses, and then I'll explain a little bit of it. Therefore, when the Lord, that would be Jesus, when the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, reference to John the Baptist, though Jesus himself did not baptize but his disciples, he competition. So he decided it's time to leave town for a while, let things cool down. He needed to go through Samaria. So he was going up toward the Sea of Galilee. He's going straight north out of Jerusalem. He was going to go right by Samaria, the very town we're talking about. So he came to the city of Samaria, which is called Sychar. This is probably Shechem, which is the original, the initial capital, very close, just within a mile or two or three of the Samaria itself. Near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph, because it's in the territory of Manasseh. Now Jacob's well was there. There was a well that was dug by the Israelites way back when, and it was named after Jacob, and it still existed in the time of Christ. And Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat by the well. It was about the sixth hour, and you wonder, what if he's thirsty? Why is he sitting by the well? Because he didn't have anything to draw the water up with. You have to wait for somebody to come. And the tradition was that somebody comes, you ask them if they would give you a drink, and then they was kind of, they were duty bound to provide the refreshment. In verse 7 of chapter 4, a woman of Samaria came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." It was a polite request. And completely within the social norms of thought of the time, for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. And the woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew," probably listening to his accent and maybe his dress was typical Jewish because he could blend into the crowd. Remember that? He didn't have any. He wasn't so handsome that he stood out in the crowd. He just looked like a regular Jewish fellow of his age at that time. "And you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman. For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans." Well, why not? Well, that's a whole other stretch of history, and it's recorded in the Bible. Some of it is. When the Assyrians took the Israelites out of Israel and hauled them north into the Assyrian homeland, they put them on their northern borders, their eastern borders, and a few even on their western border, they brought troublesome peoples that they ruled at that time. The Babylonian Empire wasn't an empire. It was a province of the Assyrian Empire in the 700s B.C. So they took some of their problematic people there, and they hauled them up and dumped them in the territory of Israel. And so by the time of Christ, some of them still live there. She's a Samaritan woman, named after the town of Samaria, which was a settlement of Gentiles. And Jesus answered, he said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." Living water. And the woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with." This is why I was asking her for a drink. She had something to draw with. "And the well is deep. So where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well?" And you think, well, how come this Gentile could be a descendant of Jacob? Well, they assumed that basically the transplanted tribes or peoples would assume some element of the religion that was there. And not all the Israelites were taken away. There were scattered few here and there, some who had a residual knowledge. And don't forget that the Jews, who were only 30 or 40 miles south, the entire Jewish kingdom was there for a considerable period of time, a couple of hundred years after. So they came back after their captivity, whereas the northern 10 tribes did not. So she was among the Samaritans, and even today you'll find this, they claim ancestry to Jacob. Technically they are from Jacob. But they are descendants of people who lived in a land that was once owned by Jacob, so that in that sense they are. That's who the Samaritans were. In fact, let's turn to 2 Kings here. And let me explain the Samaritans to you. Gives a little background, because now we go into the captivity of the 10 tribes, and that all centered around Samaria, which was its capital. 2 Kings 17, beginning in verse 24. 2 Kings 17, beginning in verse 24. "Then the king of Assyria brought people back," so we just jumped 700 years back in time, from the time of Christ, where we were meeting 700 years earlier. That's a long jump, and we're not very good at history in America because we don't have enough of it yet. But we will. "Then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon," was a favorite, somewhere north of Babylon. And they placed those in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and built the cities. Ultimately, by the time of Christ, they were largely centered around the city of Samaria. And the others had gone wherever they had gone. They'd gone wandering. And verse 25. And it was so at the beginning of the dwelling there that they did not fear the Lord. Therefore, the Lord sent lions among them and killed some of them. Nothing scares the people more than man-eating lions. But we don't have that problem in America. We have, of course, we have had man-eating mountain lions in a few instances. The Indians dealt with those. Our pioneers dealt with those. But when we're talking about the actual lions, like the African lion, can get up to 500 pounds a male, and they're terrifying. The Middle Eastern lion is what they would have had in Israel, and they aren't as big as the African lion. They can only, based on the research I've read anyway, they get up to about 350, and a little shade over that. You know, they're not really any bigger than a tiger. But what? Tigers eat more people than lions. Oh, yes. If you do a study of man-eating tigers and lions, the tigers win. That probably has to do with the jungle forest that they, in India. But there are some fascinating stories for those who like outdoor adventure of the men who hunted these things and brought it into them at various times. So anyway, they were having troubles with these smaller lions that were only as big as tigers, but they were eating some of them, and that's terrifying to a population, especially a population without firearms, because that would have been invented then. So they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, "The nations whom you removed, replaced in the cities of Samaria, do not know the rituals of the god of the land." Paganism thought that there were various gods in various places, because they were pagans, and they had no clue. And they still don't. That wasn't the case. The God of the land was God of all people. It was the true God of the Bible. Therefore, he set lions among them and gave them killing them because they don't know the rituals of the God of the land. Now, whether God sent the lions or the lions just went on themselves, God didn't prevent them. Then, verse 27, the king of Assyria commanded and said, "Send there one of the priests whom you brought from there, and let him go and dwell there, and let him teach them the rituals of the God of the land." Then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. Remember, not all the Israelites did not, rejected God. Well, the bulk of them did. And in the captivity, the whole nation was removed, including the ones that were faithful, except for the few that migrated down and lived among the Jews at that time. So there were some who knew that. And there would have been the Levitical priests working up in there, and prophets. Elijah and Elisha did all their work in the northern kingdom of Israel. And they are two of the most famous of the Old Testament prophets. Verse 28, and one of the priests whom they carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. However, every nation continued, so they learned a little bit of the truth. And this is what happened with Christianity. It has some of the truth. And then it has all kinds of pagan traditions and doctrines mixed in. So traditional Christianity isn't the original Christianity of the Bible. It has the influence of that. But it isn't their true religion. However, every nation continued to make gods of its own, in verse 29, and put them in the shrines and the high places which the Samaritans had mixed Samaritans had made. And every nation in the cities where they dwelt. And the men of Babylon made Shechemoth, and the men of Qatar, of Kuth made Nergal, and the men of Hamath made Ashamah, and so on. And in verse 32, so they feared the Lord, and from every class they appointed for themselves priests of the high places. So they mixed the bit of the true religion they were taught by that priest that was sent to them by the Assyrians, and then they mixed that in with all of their various pagan traditions. And they had this Heinz 57, which is the way Christianity has happened. In fact, it descended from a lot of that. Now we go back to John chapter 4, back to the time of Christ. That was a classic pattern of corrupting God's true religion. You give lip service to the true God, and then you worship your own pagan gods and pagan doctrines. Again, so magic wand. Make every make all the trouble go away so your life is easy. And it ignores what must be spiritually discerned. We have to study God's word and spiritually understand it. We can't just physically understand it. That doesn't work. In verse 21, Jesus said, "You're a woman. Believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain," that would be Mount Gerizim that was right next to Samaria, or what Samaria was built on, "nor in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount there, worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship because salvation is of the Jews," and it is. You think, well, the modern Jews have the knowledge of salvation? No, no. That Jew did, Jesus Christ. He had the knowledge of salvation. And the apostles were all Jewish, as they would be reckoned by that, unless they were of another tribe, but still they were generally referenced as Jewish at that time. They would carry on the true religion that Christ taught them, which we inherited down through time. Now, verse 23, goes on to say, he says, we know who we worship for salvation, yes, of the Jews, but the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit. And those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. Those are words for us. And for all that God has called right now to this time, and however long it is before Christ's second coming, until then. And the woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming." She knew what he was talking about. To a certain degree. "I know that Messiah is coming, who is called the Christ. And when he comes, he will tell us all things." And Jesus said to her, "I speak to you and he." So here, she was talking to the Messiah and learning these lessons in all of his history that was all sort of converging at that particular point. The lesson we can draw from this is that the false religion brought from Babylon was formally seeded into the beginning of Christianity, right there, northern kingdom of Israel, which was replaced or repopulated with Gentiles, and was called, the north, well, it was called, still called Israel, the territory of Israel. But it was built on the Gentiles because of the Assyrians transplanting them there. And we'll go through it another time, Acts chapter 8, but feel free to read it in the meantime, because the apostle Peter dealt with the preaching of the gospel in Samaria, around this town, and to the people who were descended, or the relatives of that lady that Jesus was talking to at the well. Now, also we need to know who was responsible for the planning of heresy. Well, the answer for that is not the Israelites or the Jews, that was, or the Gentiles, the planting of heresy, false teaching. they say it in America, 903 BC to 882. Ella from 881 to 880. Zimri, well, Zimri only ruled for 7 days in 879 to 80. Somewhere in there, he was a week-long king. And then, in Zimri's place, came Omri. Omri had a little more longevity. He lasted 10 years, but he built Samaria. He built the capital city. He strengthened the nation as nations go. Wait a minute. Notice in 1 Kings chapter 16. 1 Kings chapter 16. There's a little bit, another little tidbit on this part of the history. We'll start in verse 21 of 1 Kings 16. Then the people of Israel were divided into two parts. Half the people followed Timnah. Now, when we say the people of Israel here, this is after they rebelled from the tribe of Judah and broke off and became their own nation. So they're speaking of being the house of Israel, divided into two parts. So they had this schism in between the among the tribes. Half the people followed Timnah and half the son of Ganath who made it. To make him king, and half followed Omri. So what was going to happen? Well, verse 22, but the people who followed Omri prevailed over the people who followed Tibni, the son of Ganath. So if Tibni died, did Omri reign? Yeah, but what does the word prevailed mean? Well, either they talked faster or they fought harder. That's what it means by prevail. One or the other, or a combination of both. Whatever the case, Omri ended up being the king. And in the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, bear in mind when you read through this section, you know, who is this king and why, what's the difference with his year? They date the kings of Israel by the reign, whatever king was reigning at the time in Judah. Because the Jews had an intimate knowledge of their own history. And by referencing it back to the reign of so-and-so, in this case, Asa, king of Judah, they go, okay, yeah, I remember where that was, or I was told about that. So, in the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, Omri became king over Israel, and he reigned 12 years. 6 years he reigned in Tirzah, and he bought the hill of Samaria from Shemer for 2 talents of silver. And he built it on the hill and called the name of the city which he built Samaria after the name of Shemer, the man who he bought the land from, owner of the hill. Omri, however, did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He wasn't faithful to God's way. And he was an able leader, but he wasn't faithful to God at all. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, worse than all who were before him. For he walked in all the ways of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and in his sin, which he had made Israel sin, provoking the Lord of Israel to anger with their idols. Now in verse 27, the summary of Omri's reign. Now the rest of the acts of Omri, which he did, and the might that he showed, he was a powerful leader. He just was not faithful to God. And the power that he, or the might that he showed, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? So Omri rested with his fathers and was buried in Samaria, and Ahab, his son, reigned in his stead. And you're like, I'm almost getting to where I sort of remember where things are. But who is Ahab? For some reason why I should remember that. Yeah. There is his wife, Jezebel, was an Israelite. She was from north of Israel, from the next country up. Jezebel was notorious, but so was Ahab. In disobedience to God and his ways and fighting against God. Now, a little comment on Samaria being built, capital of Israel from 880 BC. It was a strategic location, as I described. It enabled Omri to control the north-south trade routes through Israel. Archaeology indicates that Samaria was built by skilled craftsmen. You think, well, how would we know that? Because it is the most excavated historical site in the land of Israel today, Samaria. It is truly amazing, the detail that you can see of the times and the archaeological displays that they've laid around there as they brought the artifacts out. They laid them up in some of the museums and others right around the site. And it is regularly toured by thousands and tens of thousands of people who go to Israel every year on, you know, when they can. I mean, minus COVID and all that sort of thing. It is a huge significance. We don't have very many sites in America that are of historical significance because we're too young as a nation to have that. But Israel does, and so Samaria is one of the main archaeology tour sites to go to. And so the bottom line is they know a lot of stuff from Samaria. They're very systematic, the Israelis are, in their archaeology. It was a very powerful impression on it made on the Assyrian government. The Moabite stone, which is a stone that has carvings, it was dug up in Nineveh, which was the capital of Assyria at the time, you know, from back in those days. The Moabite stone tells of Omri's success as a king. Now, the Assyrians seem to do a lot of this, and they were the only ones. Others in the ancient world did as well. They carved into the stone the stone we're talking about there is about that high and yay wide and about the yay square. It's in the British Museum in London. But there are other inscriptions found on the cliffs above some of the rivers in Iraq that tell a lot of the history of Israel, what we have traced back to see, okay, that's got to be the Israelites, this people over here, that had to be them over there, based on certain things that they are said about. So the Moabite stone is a very valuable historical item. From Omri's name, time, the nation of Israel was known by to the Assyrians, and this is important in tracking what happened to the tribes. They were known as Mat Bit Gomri. They didn't say Omri like we say, they said, more of a guttural sound. So Mat Bit Gomri, the land of the house of Omri, is what that meant in Assyria. So Samaria was a huge treasure trove of archaeological historical information. Now for the tribe of Manasseh, it was the tribe that owned that territory, Omri. The Omri moniker would have a lasting influence. Remember, Manasseh is where Samaria is located. The tribal territory of Manasseh, which we recognize as the tribe that America descends from. And Omri is tied to that tribe. Thus, in tracking the tribes of Israel through history, and I'll give some of those presentations in the course of time to you, we use that a lot, the Omri moniker. Mat Bit Gomri, which got shortened to Gomri. For one thing, you can see how they began to shorten it as time went by. Now, Ahab ruled for 14 years. Mary Jezebel, princess of Sidon to the north, a Gentile territory. She was a notorious pagan queen. They resisted the faithful prophets Elijah and Elisha. So Elijah and Elisha were active during the time of Ahab as king. And probably a little before with Elijah. Then we have a series of kings coming on down, and you can read this king list that I'm going to cite here just in the names of it from 2 Kings 9. 2 Kings 9, you'll find it. But you had, after Ahab died, his son was Ahaziah. Then a king named Jehoram, or Joram was another way it's referred to. And after him came Jehu, who was the fastest chariot rider among all the kings in the New King or the King James translation. He drove furiously when he drove his chariot. He was a powerful king. Jehoash followed him. Jehoash or Joash followed them. Then we had Jeroboam the second, named after his great-great-great-great-grandfather. That happened to be 788-748. He was quite powerful. Then they had a weak king named Zechariah for 6 months, and then Shalom for 1 month. And then they had a king called Menahem, M-E-N-A-H-E-M, 746 to 737. The Assyrians invaded at that time. Now, this is in 2 Kings 15. 2 Kings 15. Turn to that, we'll read it to you. This verses 17 to 21. We're counting down in the northern kingdom, the house of Israel, not the house of Judah, not where Jerusalem is. This is the kingdom that was north of that territory of Judah, where Jerusalem was. 2 Kings 15, 17 to 21. In the 39th year of Azariah, the king of Judah, Menahem, son of they have turned back. They said, all right, you pay us off, we'll go away. We'll go back. They did not stay in the land. It was an invasion occupying forest, but they got paid off, so they went back. They didn't need to come yet. After him came the king, Pekahiah, and then Pekah. And now we're in 2 Kings 15, verse 27. In the 52nd year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekah, the son of Remaliah, became king over the children, or the Israel in Samaria, and reigned 20 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin. I think we should get adrift here that the Israelites, and later the Jews, did the same thing, though. The Israelites stopped following and being obedient to God, and God started withdrawing his blessing. Now we know that's going to happen in a similar way to our beloved nation here, and a lot of other nations that are beloved to the people who live in them, who were descended from the tribes of Israel. And ultimately, all the nations, as Christ intervenes and the great tribulation starts, there's going to be a lot of the suffering similar to what the Israelites went through. In verse 29, in the days of Peter, king of Israel, took out Philezer, the king of Assyria, came and took Ijon, Abelbeth, Makkah, Genoa, Kadesh, Asor, Gilead, Galilee, that's all the territory around the Sea of Galilee and the land of Naphtali. And he carried them away captive to Assyria. So this is the first captivity of the Israelites, and it's a good large portion of them, all in the northern half of their country. Previous invasion, he just came and took a payoff. And now he came back and they took them into captivity, which meant they conquered them and took them into captivity, used them as slaves. Largely what they did is, as I said before, they would plant them out on the outer borders of their empire. Again, these cities that probably were empty, there were places where there needed to be a city, and gave them what they needed to get started, and said, no, don't let anybody come through, or we'll come and get you. Of course, if somebody came through, how are they, the Assyrians, going to come and get them? That's another question. One of the fallacies of strategy of those days. So this was the second invasion, but the first wave of captivity. Then Hoshea, the son of Elah, verse 30, led a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and struck him. So he reigned in his place in the 20th year of Jotham, of the son of Uzziah, down in Judah. So Hoshea was ruling. And now we're in 1 Kings 17, verse 1. 1 Kings 17, verse 1. Chapter 16 deals with the threatened invasion of Judah when they were paid off. Chapter 17 gets into the captivity of Israel. In the 12th year, Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, the son of Elah, became king of Israel and Samaria. And he reigned 9 years, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, so God wasn't protecting the people. But not as the Israel, the kings of Israel who were before him, so he wasn't quite as bad as the others, but he was still bad. And Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, ran again against him. And Hoshea became his vassal, and he paid him tribute money. And the king of Assyria uncovered a conspiracy. So he made an agreement with him, then he found out why there was a conspiracy to rebel. So he sent messengers to Saul, king of Egypt. And he tried to get help to come up to fight the Assyrians, and so said, not so. Not coming. So it was in verse 7. The children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God and brought them out of the land of Egypt. But they had a Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they feared other gods, and he walked in the statutes of the nations the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel, and the kings of Israel which they had made. And it goes on, and God is giving a summary, going clear back to the time that Joshua led them into the promised land. Also the children of Israel secretly did against the Lord things that were not right. They built for themselves high places in their cities and watchtowers and fortified city. They set up for themselves sacred pillars. These were shrines to pagan gods and goddesses. Yeah, well, you know, what's wrong with a little, religious diversity? Well, you know how almost all the pagan gods and goddesses were worshipped? By adultery. Raping. Partying. And adultery. And then the highlight, child sacrifice. That's how they were worshipped. You think God loved that? We would shouldn't make excuses for the ancient Israelites. They were doing the wrong things in every way. They had sacred pillars and wooden images in every high hill and under every green tree, and they burned incense in the high places like the nations who the Lord carried away from before them. And they did wicked things to provoke the Lord to anger. They served idols, which the Lord had said, "You shall not do this thing." And then in verse 13, "Yet the Lord testified against Israel and warned them, and against Judah by all his prophets, every seer, saying, 'Turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes according to the law which I commanded your fathers when I sent to which I sent to you by my servants the prophets.'" And then we see the character of Israel then, which, brethren, frankly, is the character of the Israelite nations today. Frankly, it's the character of all the nations today. Except the Israelites seem to be more driven to express it. Nevertheless, verse 14, they would not hear, wouldn't listen, but stiffened their necks, like the necks of their fathers who did not believe in the Lord their God. And they rejected his statutes and his covenant which he had made with their fathers, and his testimonies which he testified against them. And they followed idols and became idolaters and went after the nations who were all around. Or rather, all around them, concerning whom the Lord had charged them they should not do like those other nations. Verse 16, so they left the commandments, of the Lord their God, and made for themselves a golden image, and took calves, and went in image, and worshipped the host of heaven, all kinds of god and goddesses. And they served most of all. And they caused their sons and daughters to pass through the fire. That was child sacrifice. That's what it means by pass through the fire. They would burn babies on the arms of the metal figures of these pagan gods and goddesses. They practiced witchcraft. They practiced soothsaying, another kind of witchcraft. They sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight, and there was none but the tribe of Judah alone, the house of Judah to the south. So God took the 10 tribes away, cast them into captivity. And in chapter 17 of 2 Kings, verse 17, verse 19, Judah wasn't much better. They weren't as bad as the Israelites were then. God measures, I guess, the level of sin. He has a keen insight into that, a perfect insight into it. Also, Judah did not keep the commandments of the Lord, but they walked in the statutes of Israel which they made, and the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel, afflicted them, and delivered them in the hand of plunderers until he had cast them out of his sight. And he tore Israel from the house of David, and they made Jeroboam the king, and Nebat the king, and then Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord, and made them commit great sin. For the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam which he did, and they did not depart from them, until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he said by all of his servants the prophets. So Israel was carried away from their own land to Assyria, as it is to this day. They were still there when this was written by the chronicler. And later, of course, they moved. And up to that time, they were there. The house and then the 10 tribes didn't come back. There were remnant families that came back. Either came back on their own, or were actually already down among the Jews because they were faithful to God. And so we have in history, occasionally we find somebody from this tribe or that tribe being mentioned even in the New Testament. That's why. The 10 tribes were gone, wandering on their own. Empty-headed pagans is what they were. The house of Israel was conquered by Assyria, the whole 10 tribes taken captive into the Assyrian Empire. Now, this is a tidbit of historic connection and how we track the tribes, the names, based on Omri, king of Israel, or Gomri. Sometimes there would be a G sound. Apparently that was something Assyrians, that's how they spoke his name at first contact. So you had the core consonant sounds. Bear in mind, why are we worried about consonants? Well, that's how words are formed. Vowels can change, but the consonants will stay the same. Also, ancient Hebrew was only written in consonants. The vowels aren't there. They were handed on by word of mouth, so they had to figure it out. The experts did ultimately to get this here, K. The M sound is there, and the R sound is there. And you look for words that tie into that. And that's exactly how the story ends up tracking. Aubrey-based names are Gomery, Cymmeri, Cymmerians. The Cymmeri is in the Cymmeri of Wales. That's who they descended, claim to be descended from. And the Cymmeri. The four consonants of America are C-K-M-R. The vowels changed, but the core sounds are there. The consonants shape the word. Jacob, notice Jacob's blessing. We have time for Jacob's blessing, and I guess we do. It's in Genesis 48. This is a critical blessing when he put his blessing on Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph. We believe, and from our studies, and I think we're very accurate and careful and systematic on that, along with a lot of others who don't know the rest of God's truth, but they know this part of it, who are great historians. America is descended from Manasseh, the tribe of Manasseh. Samaria was in the territory of Manasseh. And Ephraim, or Britain, is descended from Ephraim. And I can go in a whole other lecture that can explain how that works. But so chapter 48, verse 14, so Joseph brought them. This is the time of the blessings. Jacob is almost ready to die, but he's going to hand out the blessings. And he's the great patriarch. He is God's man on the earth. And so what he said would be prophetic, that would be fulfilled. So he was going to give blessings to each of his sons. And they were very happy, of course, to find that Joseph hadn't been killed and was, in fact, their benefactor in Egypt. And so Joseph wasn't blessed himself. He brought his sons forward, Ephraim and Manasseh, to be blessed by their grandfather, Jacob. So Joseph brought them, his sons, from beside his knees, and he bowed down on his face to the earth, and Joseph took them, both Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand. Ephraim was the younger, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand. Because the right hand would have a greater blessing, and the left hand would have a lesser blessing. So he wanted them placed. Remember, Jacob was basically blind by this time, as mentioned earlier in the record. And they brought them near him, and Israel stretched out his right hand, and he laid it over here on Ephraim, and his left hand he put on Manasseh. So he gave the greater blessing to the younger grandson, and the lesser blessing to the other grandson. And they, well, yeah, but America's the greatest nation now. Britain's nothing. Well, you need to go read some history, and you'll find out that America is great. In its time, before its time, England would have paled us to insignificance by comparison to the other nations around it. We had British Empire was phenomenal. It's just that it has gone, and America's empire is still here. We are part of it. We think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. But it is like all human endeavors that don't follow God. It will come to its end. The good news is, in the world tomorrow, the millennial rule of Christ, after he has returned and set everything straight, Manasseh and Ephraim will both be great again. Nations and residual populations, the little bit that survives, will be a benefit to mankind in general. So guiding his hands knowingly for Manasseh was the firstborn, he blessed Joseph, and he said, the God of my fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Isaac, the God who fed me my long life to this day, the angel who redeemed me, angel means messenger, God in a sense is his own messenger at times, redeemed me from evil, blessed the last, let my name be named on them, so the name of Israel or Jacob was named upon them, and let the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth, these two sons would. Now when Joseph saw his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim and displeased him, so he took hold of his father to remove it to from Ephraim's hand and Manasseh's hand, their hand rather. And Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this is the firstborn, put your right hand on his head. And his father said, refuse. Jacob refused, and he said, I know, my son, I know. And he, Manasseh, also shall become a people, and he shall also be great. The single greatest nation in the world's history. America has been that, and is that right now. But truly, his younger brother Ephraim shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. The America That's right.